You know, we've talked about this idea of the narrow road in many other lessons. The narrow road that Jesus defines in Matthew 7, verse 13 and 14, that leads to life. And really, you cannot be on that narrow road or that narrow way unless you are a Christian. I know that sounds offensive to someone who isn't a Christian or doesn't want to be a Christian and thinks that they're right with God nonetheless. But that's what Jesus teaches. That's what the rest of the New Testament teaches. I should also say that you cannot be a faithful Christian unless you remain on that narrow way. So even though we've become Christians, doesn't mean that we're guaranteed salvation just because we made a decision. We have to keep making that decision, in essence, every day, all the time, no matter what. But that narrow way or that narrow road is not going to accommodate your baggage. And the baggage really is whatever you want to carry with you while you walk, if we can look at it that way. And that baggage represents to us a negative thing. It is an encumbrance of some kind. In this case, it is an unnecessary weight. It is a hindrance to our achieving our goal. It is something that gets in the way. It is something that makes us less effective or something that makes us less efficient. Effective means doing the right things. Efficient means doing the right things rightly. In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, the writer there says, "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every baggage." Well, he says the word encumbrance, but you know what he's talking about. "Every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith." Or there's three basic things that are mentioned so far. First of all, there is every encumbrance. And that encumbrance might be different things to different people. For some, it might be bitterness or jealousy or anger or greed. For others, it might be a debilitating fear, a painful childhood, a deep-seated hurt. For some, it might be a religion or something that they carried with them for years and years or decades since their childhood. They were taught some things or they heard some things or a preacher told them some things and they've just carried that with them. And it really wasn't the right thing to hear or the right thing to believe, but they believed it anyway and now there they are. And for some, it's just sheer indifference or apathy. Indifference means, yeah, you can go either way. I'm okay with that. Apathy is, I don't really care what happens. And both of those can be an encumbrance to a person. Then there's the entanglement of sin that the writer talks about. And that's what trips us up while we're trying to walk the narrow way. The problem itself is universal. Sin is sin, regardless of what it looks like. So everyone has to deal with sin. But the manifestation of the problem may vary. For some, it might be money or material possessions or sexual sins, or idolatry in any form, illicit relationships. It may even be your own spouse or the kind of relationship that you have with him or her, or your enemy, or what is most frequently the biggest problem is our own pride. The third thing that's mentioned there is running that race with our eyes fixed on Jesus rather than being fixated instead on the world. The race represents a successful life of a Christian, but that's impossible to run that race, of course, if you are encumbered and entangled and not focused on the author of life. I mean, imagine that, trying to run a race when you've got all kinds of, you know, things you're trying to carry and ropes around your legs that are loosely tied or, you know, stumbling blocks along the way, things that you're trying to avoid, but they trip you up. And that's really what he's talking about there. You can't walk the narrow way if you're weighed down with worldly baggage or the burden of sin. It's like trying to swim across a lake where you got a big anchor hanging around your neck. You're just not going to make it very far. And in fact, you will not make it at all. And despite the simplicity of that logic, many people, including Christians, cling tightly to their baggage. They refuse to let it go, even though it goes against what the scriptures teach and perhaps what they know to be true themselves intuitively. Even so, they cling to their baggage and think that somehow, some way, Jesus is going to be mistaken, because Jesus says you got to get rid of those things and let go of this world and not try to save your own life. But someone thinks that, but I can do this. I really am able to do this, which implies that Jesus is wrong and that we are smarter than him. I wonder if that happens to anyone here in this building. Is anyone here trying to walk the narrow way while wheeling a five-piece luggage set that's, say, filled with bricks and cast iron and lead? Are we trying to swim to the shores of heaven, so to speak, while having an anchor tied around our neck? I mean, it's so easy to do. And if so, if that's our situation, how successful are we going to be? And how far are we going to get? Do we really think that that's going to work? The fact is, not only will you fail, if that is your perspective, but you will likely be instrumental in misleading other people as well. And that is just something you cannot afford to do. I think one of the classic responses to that is something to the effect of, well, that's just the way I am. My response to that is, no, that is the way you've chosen to be. That's not the way that you are. It's not a genetic thing here. It's really a decision that you have made. And you can unmake that decision in the same way that you made it. Jesus does not expect us to fail. Because of his grace and mercy, he expects us to succeed. But you have to listen to what he says, and then you have to do what you heard. You know, one of the overarching themes of the Bible is this, that I will be their God and they will be my people. That is just, I find it everywhere. I find it in those words, I find it in so many words, and I find it in principle all throughout Scripture. And yet within that major principle, there are other paradoxical themes, such as fellowship comes through sacrifice, grace comes through faith, life comes through death, salvation comes through loss. And another paradoxical theme that I'm pointing out in this lesson is that drawing near to God, or drawing near to heaven, however you want to look at that, God is heaven if for us, necessarily requires a separation from this world. Drawing near to God necessarily requires drawing away from this world, or drawing away from whatever is tethering us to this world. You might look at it in that respect here. Years ago, Janis Joplin, I'm quoting her only because of what she said, not because of her, said, you know, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And some people do look at it like that, but that's not really true. Spiritual freedom is a conscious, deliberate decision to leave behind whatever you have to leave behind, whatever is necessary to leave behind in order to pursue God. So as Christians, if indeed we are Christians here this morning, we have to choose every day to leave things behind in order to draw near to God. Because you're not, and I want to emphasize this, you are not going to draw near to God just because you are a Christian, just because you went to church, just because you just sang a bunch of songs, just because you took the Lord's Supper. Those things do not make you drawing near to God. What makes you or brings you closer to God is your decision to do so, and your follow through with that. Drawing near to God then is not a state of existence that you find yourself in over time or accidentally or while you're looking for something else. You know, I was looking for, you know, this over here and I accidentally stumbled into drawing near to God. You know, that just doesn't happen, okay? Nobody stumbles into heaven and nobody stumbles into a good relationship with God or fellowship with God. It's something you have to voluntarily choose and accept. It doesn't just happen because you have to strive to pursue it instead. But the paradox is, once again, paradox meaning in this case, something that doesn't seem to be right up front, but really is. The paradox is if you leave everything else behind for the right reason and in the right manner, then you get everything that you were really looking for in the first place. So the things that we cling to, we think that they're going to benefit us somehow. They're going to be advantageous to us. That's why we're clinging to them. But the fact is, the paradox is, Jesus says, if you let go of those things and grab onto this other thing here instead, which is our faith in him and all that he says is true, grab onto that and don't let go. You're going to gain everything that you thought you were going to gain when you were clinging to these other things. And the Bible is filled with examples of men and women who left things behind for God. In Genesis chapter 12, Abram left behind his homeland, his family, and his security in order to pursue God. God, in essence, said to him, if you leave these other things and people behind, I will enrich you with greatness. He did so, and God did so. Abram left those things behind, and God enriched him with greatness. In Exodus 3 and 4, Moses did the same thing, but it was sent in the opposite direction. Instead of leaving his the security behind that he had, he actually left his pastoral life, his quiet life there, and went to deliver Israel from the land of Egypt. So Abram left the busy life of where he was to the quiet pastoral life. Moses left the quiet pastoral life of where he was in order to go into the business, if you will, the busyness of doing what needed to be done. The book of Ruth is talking about a woman named Ruth who left behind her own land, her culture, and her people in order to embrace the monotheistic or one God religion of the Jews. And as a result, she gained the privilege of being listed in the lineage of the Messiah. In Luke chapter 5, verse 1 through 11, we read the account in our scripture reading. Peter, James, and John, even though they had this great catch of fish, imagine filling two boats, so much so the boats began to sink. What a powerful picture. And when they returned to shore, they left everything and followed him. It ends, that section ends that way. They left everything and followed him. And then you can read about Matthew, otherwise known as Levi, who also did the same thing. It says that after that, Jesus went out, noticed a tax collector named Levi sitting in a tax booth, and he said to him, follow me, and he left everything behind, got up, and began to follow him. That's impressive. In Acts chapter 19, verse 18 through 19, we have a bunch of people who formerly were sorcerers and magicians. And they became Christians when they heard the word, obeyed the word, and did what was necessary for that obedience. Many of also these who had believed kept coming, confessing, and disclosing their practices, it says. And many of those who practiced magic brought their books together, began burning them in the sight of everyone. They counted up the price of them and found it to be 50,000 pieces of silver. That doesn't matter what value that is to us. What matters is what value it was to them. This was something important to them. They took their books of magic, whatever once was a source of pride, source of status, and yes, most certainly a source of revenue, and they consigned it to the flames. They put it on the fire because now it didn't mean anything to them. And instead of, and this is admirable, giving it to someone else so that they could pursue it as a source of status and revenue, they just simply destroyed it, which is what they should have done. In Philippians chapter 3, verse 7 and 8, we find that Paul left behind everything. He left behind a life of influence and status, an entire career as a rabbi for something better than that. He considered everything rubbish in comparison to knowing Christ. I mean, that's what he says here. Whatever things were gained to me, those things I have counted as loss for the sake of Christ. More than that, I count all things to be loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things. So here's a man who considered everything rubbish in comparison. When put up next to knowing Christ, everything else fails. It is only Christ that is worth anything, and everything else, by comparison, is not worth anything. Jesus Christ is better than whatever he left behind. That's what he believed. But now I want you to make it personal and ask yourself, what do you believe? Are you asked to leave these things behind in order to draw near to God? Yes, you are. No one can do this for you. No one will do it for you. I can't do it for you, and you certainly can't do it for me. But like Abram, we must leave our family behind. And I know this is kind of a sticking point for a lot of people, whether they'll admit it or not. We're not talking about leaving your family behind literally, like abandoning your family and leaving them in the lurch, that sort of thing. But in your heart, to recognize that Christ is more important than your own family. In order to seek greatness with God, and that's what he wants you to do, you must leave behind the ties and the connections of this world. Easy to say, I realize, very difficult sometimes to do. In fact, if you look at the passage that I have there in Matthew chapter 10, you realize that Jesus says some pretty strong language here with regard to this very subject here. And I think it is worth at least our understanding of what he's saying. And starting in verse 34, he says, "Don't think I came to bring peace." And that peace isn't just, you know, peace in a national sense, you know, like nation with nation. He's talking about family with family or even within families. Don't think that I came here to make everybody good friends with everyone else or to make everyone like everyone else. That's not his purpose. That's not why he came, but rather to divide. Now, that's not his purpose either, to divide, but he knows that it will divide. When someone hears the gospel and someone rejects the gospel, there's a division. And then he goes on and talks about how this division will even be in the midst of a family. A wife will believe, a husband will not. There's a division. A husband and wife will believe, the adult children will not. Well, there's a division. Some of the children believe, some of the children will not. There's a division. The children believe, the parents do not. There's a division. And so he understands that, and he actually explains that. But then he goes on in verse 37 and says, "He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me." And I think that is a profound statement, because we all love our moms and dads, I hope. At least we're supposed to, right? There's an intuitive understanding that that's what we're supposed to do, but we're supposed to love Christ even more than them. And so what we're not always seeing among those who profess to be Christians is this love for Jesus that transcends even a love for anyone or everyone else. But rather, we see people clinging to their family ties, their family traditions, their family decisions, even at the expense of their allegiance to Christ. And understand what Jesus is saying. When he says that you are not worthy of me, if you do that, that means you'll lose your soul if that is your decision. That's what's on the line here. Meanwhile, Christ asks each one of us, "Have you left family and loved ones behind to follow me?" Think about what he asked Peter there in John chapter 21, verse 15. "Do you love me more than these?" It's a great question to ask. It's a great question to ask ourselves. Do you love Christ more than these? And it really doesn't matter who the these are. It could be anyone and everyone. Do you love him more? Like Moses, we need to leave behind the quiet, comfortable, easy life that we might have created for ourselves in order to fulfill whatever ministry or mission that God has assigned to you. I'm not saying you have to become a foreign missionary. That's not what I'm getting at. In fact, I even said in class this morning, I think very few people are capable of entering into that kind of lifestyle. Nonetheless, we all have a mission. And God is not leading us to go into Egypt, but he is leading us to Christ. And in being led to Christ, you have to accept whatever discipleship Christ has given to you. But that's not what I often see in Christians, or those who call themselves Christians. I see people settling into a very comfortable lifestyle, a lifestyle centered around TV shows, entertainment, perhaps revolving around their kids or their grandkids, creature comforts. One of the common phrases I hear anymore, especially when I'm trying to get people to get serious about their spiritual life, is the "I'm too busy" thing. And it's a tedious and tiring phrase, because really all it is trying to escape commitment rather than define an actual situation. Because the matter remains, busy doing what? And is what you're doing that you're so busy with very important? And who decided that it was important, and who decided that you're going to be busy doing it? So often we allow things to come into our path. We allow stumbling blocks to come into our way. Imagine that. Imagine someone who's trying to run a race. And it's not just the fact that there are stumbling blocks there that he needs to, you know, dance around and jump over and things to avoid there in his path, but that he's the one that's actually putting them there. That he's the one who's actually placing these things in his own path. Like he's got a bunch of things and he's throwing them in his own path and then tripping over them. You say, well, how absurd is that? People do it all the time. They collect a bunch of things in their life, they throw them in their way, and then they trip over them. And that's just an absurd thing to think about, but then we look at ourselves, and what are we doing? Are we doing this? Christ, meanwhile, asks, are you willing to leave your comfortable life to follow me? Like Ruth, we have to leave behind, perhaps, our own culture, our family's expectations of us, the traditions and symbols of our ethnic heritage that we might be very proud of, and rightly so. But all these things must be surrendered in order to follow Christ. In other words, if there is ever any kind of challenge to Christ with those things are what has to leave and not your allegiance to Christ. But that's not what we always see. What we see often, and this is becoming more and more popular and common here, is we're seeing people cramming Christ and the church and the Bible into their culture. In other words, they've got their culture, they've got how they want to live and all their cultural ideas and expectations and everything, all the trappings of it, if you will. And then Christ gets crammed into the middle of all that rather than Christ defining who we are. And if culture has a place in there, fine. But if it doesn't, fine. And that culture may be a culture that revolves around age or gender, race, nationality, vocation, even recreational pursuits. Meanwhile, Christ keeps asking us, is your desire to preserve your culture more important than your discipleship to me? Will you withhold those things that stand in the way in order to follow me? Or will you uphold your family's traditions at my expense? Well, like Peter, James, and John, and Matthew himself, we must leave behind whatever material gains that we have made or thought that were important to us in order to follow Christ. Now, this doesn't mean what it sounds like up front, like we all need to become impoverished, right? All become paupers and live in the poorhouse or whatever expression works for you there. That's not what he's saying. But what he's saying is that don't allow those things, that money, that material gain, that possessions, whatever it is, the things that you might be clinging to now, don't let those things become your stumbling blocks. Remember the rich young ruler. He's outside of our lesson this morning, but you know the account. You can read about him in Matthew in chapter 19. When confronted with a choice, at least he made a decision. I'll give him credit for that. When Jesus says, sell your riches and come follow me, at least he made his decision to not sell his riches and follow Jesus. He made his decisions to walk away, a decision rather, to walk away. And what I'm seeing today, becoming more and more popular and common, is Christians and people who call themselves Christians thinking that they can make a decision to follow Christ and drag along their wealth and riches and material gains with them. In other words, we honor the rich young ruler for at least having the guts, if you will, the courage to make a decision one way or the other. But we're seeing people today being oblivious to the idea that you have to choose. And so they think that they're following Christ while they're ensnared in all of their material life. You can't say yes to both sides all at once. You pick one side or the other. Like the sorcerers in Ephesus, we have to leave behind all the remnants of our formerly satanic life. And don't keep those things as mementos and relics and sentimental attachments to us. Imagine, instead of burning books of magic, which probably none of us have, but imagine we're burning other books or magazines or videos or CDs or things like that that are all very ungodly in nature and contain all kinds of ungodly things, and we throw those on the fire instead. Maybe what we literally need to do is have an actual bonfire in which we just bring all of our junk like that and throw it on there in the presence of all and say, that's what we're talking about right there. Instead of selling it at a garage sale for someone else to be misled by or to stumble over, let's just get rid of it altogether, destroy it like we should have done in the first place. Like Paul, we have to consider all things of this life, this world, as rubbish in comparison to knowing Christ. That doesn't mean everything is rubbish immediately. What it means is in comparison to, and that's the key idea there. Knowing Christ is not just becoming a Christian in status or being baptized. Knowing Christ refers to having a meaningful and realistic fellowship with the Lord on His terms, not on yours. You don't get to make the terms because you're the one who needs what He offers. He's the one in authority. He's the one who has what you need. He has the gift of mercy and grace, and He's willing to give it to you, but you've got to prepare yourself for that. And just as Paul never looked back, neither should you or I ever look back with regret or sadness or fondness. We should never look back and say, oh, wasn't it fun when we used to, you know, insert favorite sinful activity. Those were the good days. Those were good times. No, they weren't, actually, because that's what led you away from God. There's nothing good about that. Let it go. Walk away from it. And don't turn back. No one has left behind more than Christ has left behind. And yet some might protest at that and say, well, it's not as difficult as what he's asking of us, you know, what he did. All he had to do is come from heaven and, you know, come to this world and, you know, go to a cross and just think about what you're saying, right, as you're saying it. You know, it's not as hard as what he's asking me to do. No, you're right. It's not as hard. It's even harder than what we're being asked to do. In fact, it's not even comparable. We can't even comprehend what he gave up, because he gave up things we've never even had or seen in the first place. We have never seen what he lived in as being a divine son of God. We've never seen his glory, his majesty, all the wonders of heaven, surrounded by angels, hearing the songs of heaven and all the glory and splendor. We've never even seen that. And he left all that for us. And we think, oh, Jesus is asking me to give up this friendship or this addiction or this habit or this thing in my life. And it's so hard. He doesn't understand what it's like. Really? We don't understand what it's like for him to have left behind what he did. And we will never understand in this life. We can't imagine what he did to empty himself and leave all that behind. He didn't cease to be God, but he did leave behind all the glory and the majesty and the rightly deserved praise as God. And then he turns to us and says, I need you to leave these things behind. And instead of protesting, and instead of comparing, you know, like what we're having to leave behind with what he left behind, and instead of, you know, trying to negotiate, like, oh, okay, I'll leave this behind, but how about if I keep that? Instead of doing any of those things, what we should do in our obedience, in our submission, and in our faith, what we should do is just simply say, yes, Lord, and leave it behind. Walk away. And not look back. Jesus taught some very difficult things there to the people in John chapter 6. You can read all that about eating his body and drinking his blood. And unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you do not have me in yourselves, etc. And all those things that were really difficult for the people to accept. Not difficult to understand in context, but difficult because it defied their expectations of what was expected of them, as well as their expectations of Messiah. And so a lot of them began to no longer follow him. It says the multitudes began to turn away and withdrew from him. And Jesus turns to his own 12 handpicked disciples and says, you're not going to go away too, are you? To which Peter says, rightly, who else are we going to go to? Who else has what you have? Who else says what you say? Who else can do what you do? Who else can offer what you offer? Who else can give us life that you promise? How would you answer if Jesus asked you, you're not going to go away also, are you? How would you answer? Later in Matthew chapter 19, verse 27, the disciples say, well, we've left everything and followed you. What then will there be for us? That's a good question. It's a fair question to ask. But Jesus says, everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or farms for my name's sake will receive many times as much and will inherit eternal life. Think about what he did in his answer. He just covered all the things that we just talked about. All those things that people cling to and cling tenaciously to and don't want to let go of, thinking that they're going to be of some advantage to them, that it's so important that they cling to this thing here on this earth. And what Jesus is saying, if you leave all that behind, you're going to gain much more than that. Not just in the heaven to come, but even right now, you'll gain much more than that. Something more valuable than all of that. And you have to believe that, because if you don't, then you're not going to leave those things behind. And I can tell you this just by observation, that those people who do cling to those things and don't let go of them really don't believe what Jesus is saying right here. They're proving it by their actions. Just as a person must be fully immersed in the water in order to be united with Christ, I'm speaking of baptism there, so he must be fully emptied in order to follow him. Paradox there. There's no room on the narrow path or the narrow way for our personal baggage, our mementos, our status, our former convictions that were proved wrong by the gospel. So, really, what about you? What is so special, so dear, so precious, so important to you that you would rather cling to that instead of clinging to Christ? I'm saying this rhetorically, not accusing anyone of actually doing this, but just simply saying, if that is the scenario, what is it that's so important? Family ties? Your spouse? Your children? Your status? Maybe it's your comfortable lifestyle, your comfortable home. Maybe it's your wardrobe, your money. Maybe it's entertainment or recreation. You just don't want to give it up. Maybe it's your TV or your internet or your electronic toys, your video games, or, you know, sophisticated gadgetry. You just don't want to give it up. That to you is more important. And you say, well, no, it's not. But then you go home and there you go. There's your time. There's your attention. There's your devotion to those things. Maybe it's your desire to relive over and over again the pain that you felt in the past, and you're carrying around this big grudge and this grief and this bitterness and the bitterness of those who have sinned against you, who have been unjust toward you. And you're carrying that around and thinking that if I cling to this, then things will be better. I'll get what I want. I'll feel that satisfaction, that gratification that I'm longing for, that completion that I'm seeking. Maybe it's your self-pity over all the things you've been deprived of. Or maybe it's your sympathies of others that you crave. You know, like, you know that you've been deprived, but people admire you for being so deprived. And you become kind of like a self-made martyr. And, oh, look at you. You've had to put up with this. Oh, this happened to you. And, you know, that happened. Oh, you must be a courageous, noble person. You're thinking to yourself, yes, I am. And you just don't want to give that up. And that becomes more important to you than your allegiance to Christ. Maybe it's your crutch, whatever your crutch might be. I'm not talking about literal crutches, of course. I'm talking about what you use to prop yourself up. Your rationalizations, your justifications, your stories that you cling to in order to excuse yourself from responsibility. Well, I would be a faithful Christian. I would be more faithful to this congregation, except that there's this thing in my life, this thing that goes on, this story that I am going to unravel for you, and this yarn that I'm going to spin for you, and all these things that I have as justification, all rationalizations that I'm going to offer to you. Maybe it's your religious beliefs, your personal convictions. What you believe in is so strong, so powerful. What you think is right is so much a part of you that you just will not give that up, even in the face of clear evidence that defies it. And when your life ends, because it will end someday, when it ends, will those things, those people, those affections, those excuses, those convictions, are they going to save you? How's that going to help you? What are they going to do for you? When you leave this earth behind, you leave all of that behind. And then what? Do you believe that God will save you? Well, if you do, then you have to listen to what God says. Back to Hebrews chapter 12. Since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Well, why should you do that? Well, because there's an objective in mind. Because we should be fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, because he's the one who holds everything that we need, that we desperately need, and honestly, that we really want. So, whatever encumbrance, every sin, any sin, it's not so important that you cling to that. Rather, it's important that you get rid of that or let go of that if indeed anything that you're doing stands in the way of what God has to offer you. God wants to be your God, and he wants you to be his child. That requires that you do something, and that something may be radical, it may be difficult, it may be even very painful. Most of the world is not listening to God. And even a great percentage of those who call themselves Christians are not listening to God. The question is, this morning, are we listening to God? And I can even make it more personal, are you listening to God? It takes strong faith to listen to God, to accept what he says and do what he says to do. But this is exactly what you ought to be pursuing, strong faith. And not, I know I should do this, not, I wish I could do this, but by your faith and God's grace, you will do this, because you can do this. That's the message for you this morning. If there's anyone here who's ready to commit to Christ, who's ready to leave everything else behind, who's ready to leave this world behind and jump at the chance and cling tenaciously at the Savior's offer here for life, to think about what we have at stake here, how important that is. If there's anyone here that's willing to make that step, be baptized into Christ, become the Christian that he needs you to become, and then follow him on that narrow way, then this is your opportunity to come forward if you need to, as we stand and sing the song Richard has selected for us.